Well, it's now my honor to introduce General Brent Scowcroft, who will be addressing us. The mission of this committee is to identify the social and behavioral sciences that are relevant to both the conduct of intelligence analysis and the creation of organizations that will support sound analysis. And as part of our information gathering, we're trying to understand what are the needs of the new recruits going through Analysis 101, and I guess some of their managers are going through Analysis 101 as well, and then we'd be very privileged to hear what the needs of intelligence analysis look like from the various tops. So this is General Brent Scowcroft, who really goes without any introduction, a former national security advisor and so on. So welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you. I'm not sure what I can contribute, but I will try. And I think the whole practice of intelligence is very much behavioral science oriented, although sometimes we tend to think it's a pure science, and it certainly isn't. But let me start with some general propositions. First of all, I am basically a consumer. In other words, my time in the government has been consuming intelligence. But I've had a lot to do with the relationship between the producers and the consumers and how to make it better. What I don't know is the internal mechanisms of the intelligence community entities. Very basically, what's the purpose of intelligence? It is to reduce uncertainty in the mind of the decision maker. Now, there are lots of ramifications of that and subheadings, but that's basically what it's for. You've got a problem out here, and you're looking at all the different factors of the problem, and intelligence is one that brings up the environment. It's like, you know, you're getting dressed in the morning. You'd like to listen to the radio and know what the weather forecast is, so you know how to dress. It's not always right, is it? But it that's sort of the function intelligence produces. And that is to make more certain, more comfortable, a decision on the part of the decision maker, to reduce all of the unknowns. And most of the important decisions are made in the face of large numbers of unknowns. So that the degree to which you can reduce it is very important and comforting for the decision makers. Now, how do you do that? Well, the first thing you have to do is to communicate. The intelligence analyst, the producers of intelligence, have to communicate to the decision maker. Now, that sounds pretty straightforward, but it is not. And one of the problems we've had in recent years is that the producers of the intelligence tend to be talking to each other, not when the decision maker reads this. What is it going to mean to him? Not what does it mean to you. Does it mean the same thing to you or to him that it does to you? And we've had a lot of miscommunications on that score, including a recent one on the recent Iranian NIE. When the intelligence community was saying one thing, and what you read out of the document was something entirely different. Then we need to communicate what we know and what we don't know. And the emphasis is on what we do know, usually, but it's just as important to say what we really don't know, because that's an uncertainty. And don't hedge it. Don't say, well, it may be this. What we don't know is very important. Then when you say, we think probably this is going to happen, what does probably mean? So we've established an elaborate code of what degree of confidence we have in the information. Is it high confidence? Is it moderate? Is it uncertainty? The problem is that those are not really quantifiable terms. If you say moderate confidence is 60%, what does that mean? That means 40% of the time you're wrong. And how does a decision maker know? Can you give him any clues whether it's likely to be the 60%? Objectively, it is. But substantively, it's a very hard thing to communicate the level of confidence. And one of the ways to do that is to cite different analysts who have different notions about it. And if it's an important point, say, analyst A says is highly confident because 1, 2, 3. Analyst B is skeptical because of 1, 2, 3. Then the decision maker can balance these off. Even better if he knows the analyst, which is rarely the case in the sense of the president. But those are the kinds of things that you have to communicate to the decision maker. And the more precision you can put into it, actual precision, not false precision, because in fact the decision maker is usually looking for precision. He wants to be told what the thing is, not add to his own confusions. Then you have to describe the source of the information. If, for example, it is clandestinely rather than open source literature, where did it come from? And how much faith do you have in the source? And one of the famous stories about that, of course, is the information that Hardball provided on Iraq. Now, the intelligence was, boy, just exactly what we wanted to hear. But Hardball wouldn't pass any serious intelligence scrutiny. But for a variety of reasons, which we can get into it later, that was obfuscated. And so that's another of these imponderables that have to go together in giving, in communicating to the decision maker as precisely as you can what it is you're telling him. Then the last thing is to make clear any assumptions on which your analysis is based. And I'll give you a little story about that one. And that is the Yom Kippur War in 1973, which surprised us and surprised the Israelis. And I remember on the morning that attack took place, it was Saturday morning, and we learned about it about 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. About an hour later, I read the president's daily briefing on that issue. And, of course, it was written before the attack took place. But what it said was the military exercises of the Egyptians and the Syrians are unusually realistic this year. Now, you bet they were. But what had happened is an interesting story, because they had military exercises every fall. But we assumed, for one, first the Israelis, we had beaten up on them after the 67 war when they preempted and said, that's really bad. Don't do that again. So they were in a no preemption thing. So they didn't read it. And for us, we said, it makes no military sense for the Egyptians and the Syrians now to attack Israel. They can't win, so they're not going to do it. But what we missed was Sadat had something very different in mind. he was still smarting and in a bad position from his defeat in the 67 war. What he wanted to do was move just far enough and stop so he could restore the confidence of the Egyptians in their army, the Egyptian army, and so on, and establish a basis from which he could negotiate. We didn't think about that. So we were surprised because it didn't make sense. Our assumptions were that it didn't make sense. Now, did it make a difference? I don't know. But those are the kinds of things you have to think about when you're doing the analysis. One of the other things I was going to talk about later, but I might as well do it now, is the kind of internal assumptions that are made by, sometimes by the analysts. And one of the famous cases of that was the A-team, B-team exercise that took place, I believe, in 1976. An analysis of Soviet Union military strength and intentions. And there were a lot of, let's say, conservatives at the time who said that the intelligence community was painting too rosy a picture of the Soviet Union. So they set up a deliberate exercise. Team A was the CIA team, did their regular thing. Then they collected a bunch of people who ideologically were very skeptical of the Soviet Union, the hard rock conservatives, and asked them to evaluate the same data. That's Team B. Now, did Team A and Team B come up with the same analysis? No, they didn't. Team B was much more skeptical. But it was a very useful exercise. Incidentally, history indicates Team A was more accurate. So these are the kinds of things that go into making analysis. And that is, all of these are what analysis does to raw intelligence. And one other little story, one of the problems that sort of surfaced in the Bush administration is that groups like people in the Pentagon were asking for the raw intelligence to look. Well, one of the problems is you can pick out of raw intelligence on most important issues almost anything you want to see. The purpose of analysis is to go through this list so that you can call out the things that which are going to lead you in the wrong direction. So that's why raw intelligence is not just so that the intelligence community can control a product. It's so that it is useful for someone whose job it is to walk through this list of things you have to worry about in order to come up with intelligence that is meaningful. Now, what are some of the general problem areas? You know, what is the general relationship of intelligence to policy? That's a very tough question. Should, for example, the DNI or the director of CIA and so on, should he sit in on policy discussions of the NSC? Well, you can come to two conclusions. You can say, yes, he can, because he needs to understand the policy that is being discussed and its ramifications, so the intelligence can be tailored to deal with those specific problems. Others say, no, he shouldn't. His job is to provide as objective a picture as he can, not candid to policy. And that is a discussion which, as far as I know, has never been resolved. And different presidents have looked at it from different perspectives. Now, I said the role of intelligence is to reduce uncertainty. What is the role of intelligence if the president has already made up his mind what he wants to do? And that is one of the things that added to the complications of the Iraq issue and going into it. That is a really vexing one, especially for the intelligence community. If the president has made up his mind, do you say the duty of the intelligence community, like everyone else, is to support the policy and try to make it work, or do you say no? Our duty is to provide the best objective intelligence we can and continue to do so, even if it undermines the policy. That's another question that we haven't really come to a decision on. In the lead-up to Iraq, the administration pushed very hard on two intelligence issues. One was uranium yellow cake, which they said Saddam was trying to get from Africa. The other was aluminum tubing of a special kind. Now, why? One, you know, those don't seem important. Why? Because those two have no other use for Iraq or Saddam Hussein other than nuclear weapons. So by going there, you ipso facto prove that Saddam was after nuclear weapons. Allied with that is, what do you do when the decision maker wants the intelligence to support his policy position? And we had some of that as well. By picking and choosing, even analyst reports, you can do what you can with raw intelligence. There are other issues. Some decision makers are very enamored with the red teaming, a sort of contra idea. And it can be very, very useful because frequently it illuminates things that are not quite so obvious before. But the danger is it's not intelligence in that sense. It is an attempt to present a different picture. And while it can be very useful, it needs to be dealt with carefully. And the broader thing is, how do you deal in general with dissenting views in a constructive way? All too frequently, I think, at least of late, the solution has been within the intelligence community to compromise out the language so that there's language that they all can say, yeah, that's okay. And one of the most telling examples of that was in the famous Iraq NIE, where the NIE stated that Iran was reconstituting its nuclear weapons. Now, that meant different things to different people. And my friend here was very involved in that one. And it was something, the language they could all sign on to, but they did not all sign on to what it was we were actually communicating to the decision maker. And the decision maker, who pretty much perhaps had made up his mind by then, seized on that language for his own purposes, and the results were obvious. The intelligence community is frequently criticized for missing the big things, like they missed the end of the Soviet Union. I don't think that's valid, because I don't think that on these big seminal events that we want intelligence predicting that. I think what intelligence can usefully do in the last days of the Soviet Union is to say it's in deep trouble, there are alternative courses of action, and here are what seem to be the likely events, so that the decision maker can be prepared. But to say the Soviet Union is going to break up doesn't help very much, because first of all, nobody knows some of these things. Just a few more odds and ends. With a famous story about when a policy is successful, it's the policymaker. When it fails, it's the problem of the intelligence community. That is inherent in the process, because the job of intelligence is to improve the policy product. So if the policy is a success, the intelligence is a success. If the policy fails, it may or may not be an intelligence failure. But it's always easy for the policymaker to blame somebody else. But I don't think we should say it's not intentionally that distorted, because what intelligence is designed to do is improve the policy product. And that's its goal. Another issue is, how do you deal with generalized warnings? And the most famous example is the events leading up to 9/11. There were strong indications in the intelligence community that something was going to happen for a variety of reasons. And there were attempts to brief that to the policymaker. But that's a really hard job, to warn against something so generalized. And suppose in August, when there were really real attempts to say, there is some kind of attack coming, suppose the president said, okay, we've got to be prepared, and one of the things we've got to do is impose security checks at the airports. There would have been a revolution in August of 2011. Why? Because it wasn't apparent to the American people that they had to go through this, and it would have been the harassment that you all go through now. So those things are very hard when they're generalized, and when they demand action, when the raison for action is not clearly apparent, are very, 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 very hard to do. And I don't have an answer to that, because it happens over and over again. It also happens that sometimes in an excess of prudence, after one mistake, there will be warnings of another and another and another, so that they're on the safe side and say, well, we told you so. That's one of the really difficult problems. Well, I could tell you more war stories, but why don't I quit now and go to whatever questions you have that you think I might be able to deal with. How come you get to ask one?
I get to thank you specially for coming, Brent. Really appreciate it. Very useful. I wonder if you could take just a few minutes to talk about not the big mistakes, and not the we can pat ourselves on the back because we got something high profile right, but what happens on most issues most of the time, sort of the day in and day out process, whereby if the intelligence community does it more or less right, we've reduced some uncertainty, it produces a dialogue, it doesn't generate a headline, it doesn't generate a problem, it generates more questions and more interaction. And that so much of what people understand about the community is at the extreme ends. Yeah. Talk to the middle.
Yeah. Well, the middle actually works quite well. It is the extremes, and they become extremes mostly when the president gets involved in an important decision. But by and large, it works well. The intelligence provided gives a comfort level or a warning as the policymakers are trying to decide what to do. And I think it is on the whole, extremely productive. The only problem is that sometimes when it goes wrong in an individual case, it really fouls things up. But by and large, it is good. And by and large, as I gave you in the A team, B team, it is successful. There's another case I would give you success. In the first Gulf War, we started the conflict with an air war to try to degrade, especially his armored units, to a point that we could reduce casualties on the American side. And there was a debate about how to assess the damage we were creating. And it turned into an argument between the CIA and their methods and the Defense Department and their methods. And I instinctively sided with the Defense Department, not because I was a general, but because they had, in addition to all the other information, they had pilot reports. And when a pilot says, "I hit it," you say, "Well, that's pretty good evidence." And that became a pretty heated argument between the two. And defense was saying, "No, we're not doing as well as the CIA did." It turns out the CIA was right. We didn't know that till after the war. But those are the kinds of things. But by and large, I think we ought to be very proud of our intelligence community. What I think you wanted to hear was how you can improve it, how you can make it better. What are some of the dilemmas, which are really dilemmas of behavioral science and how you communicate and how you receive information, that we can always make better, because it's a very imprecise product. And the more times we can have a decision maker fortified by the intelligence in the right way, the better off we are. Yes.
I also very much appreciate your taking the time to speak to us. You emphasized throughout your remarks the role of the intelligence analyst as reducing uncertainty. And I want to turn that on its head. You came very close at one point to saying something else, which I hoped you would say but didn't. So I want to see if I can get you to say it. And that is, when the decision makers at least communicate that they have made up their mind, which they may or may not have, they may signal resolve when it's not there, is it the job of the intelligence analysts to increase uncertainty if they feel that the analytics suggest that the confidence of the decision maker is misguided?
Good question. Is there an answer?
I have an answer, but I'd like
well,
to
Well, I don't
experience.
Know. No, but it depends. If the administration, let's say, has firmly decided they're going to go ahead, then you can argue contrary information is not helpful and can be harmful. On the other hand, you can argue whether it helps or hurts, it is the job of the intelligence community to keep the decision maker as apprised as possible what it thinks the actual situation is. And I lean to that side. But the other side can be very persuasive, and I think if you use the example of let's say Colin Powell in his testimony before the UN, the administration, and Colin Powell knew this, had made up its mind it was going to go ahead. And so I think Colin Powell said, "I need to make the best case I can." Now, it turned out that it was a flawed case. Now, does he regret it? I don't know. But those are the practical dilemmas you have. You can argue that having made up our mind, we need to get the solidest coalition, we need to get the solidest support we can. On the other hand, we're going forward partly on a deception, or if not a deception, with lacunae in there that could make a fundamental difference. I don't know that there's an answer to that question, but it's one that the intelligence community has to agonize with. And in talking to members of them at the time of the lead up to the second Iraq war, many of them personally were agonizing. What is their role now? That's a tough one. Yes.
Much of our discussion here before you arrived was around the nature of questions that were posed by decision makers or customers to analysts. But a lot of the examples you've used have been moving in the other direction, warnings, signals that were sort of sent up. And so I'm just curious, in your experience, what has the balance of flow been? Is it more often the case that you're giving specific questions to the IC, or is it more often the case that actually information is bubbling up in the form of warnings and awareness? And I'm curious about...
Well, it's a mix, but I'd say the bulk is the intelligence community is providing. And where there are additional factors and so on is when the specific questions come. A lot of that seems to have been reversed in recent years, but because I think, you know, the decision maker was looking for particular answers to the question which would fortify where he was trying to go. But I would say predominantly it is the flow from the intelligence community to the decision maker.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Sure.
One of the points you make was the importance of clear communication in terms of decision makers can use. There are several people on the committee who part of their professional work is how to characterize uncertainty and how to communicate uncertainty. And so one of the things we've heard from Tom repeatedly is that you need an institutional commitment to, in Tom's word, make a call. That is, say something specific enough that people will know what you're talking about. So some of us say, well, what is a call that's clear enough that it could be done in an uncertain situation? So the talk that we heard just as you were coming in was from somebody Dr. Mandel, who worked with the Canadian Defense, and he showed us a set of data from the kind of the run-of-the-mill predictions where you say the intelligence community works pretty well, the test is reasonable, and where there was a unit, I guess this was Middle East and African affairs, where people had given kind of very simple probabilities to events. They say, tell me if something's going to happen, give me a time period as well, and then give me a probability. And what he found was that the analysts at varying levels of success actually did a pretty good job. When they gave a high probability, mm-hmm. it was likely to happen, low probability, wasn't mm-hmm. going to happen. They didn't weasel and give you 50% all the time. It was mostly, you know, as a consumer, is that useful?
It can be in the run-of-the-mill thing. But if it is a crucial point on which there's some differences, I think as a consumer, I would rather read the arguments for a higher estimate, the arguments for a lower estimate, so I can balance those off and have a clearer picture of what's actually going on. Because when you say a 60% confidence, you don't know what's behind that.
But you really want you can't do
that on everything. Yeah. Or you'd have the intelligence estimates far longer than they are. But on crucial points, I think the more you can help the decision maker judge, the better off you are.
We have a question here. Please come to the mic.
National security is a frame.
Could you identify yourself?
Yeah, Kent Myers, SAIC. Intelligence has always helped national security decision-making, but seems recently the role has changed. So the intelligence community has been asked to have an NIO for economics, give advice on climate change and so forth. Do you think that's out of bounds? Do you think they're working a, you know, an account that they should not, or do you think that's a good thing to include all that in security?
That doesn't bother me. I think the notion that the only purpose of intelligence is to steal secrets is off the mark. That's an important role, and it's one only the intelligence community can do. But it seems to me that the whole job of intelligence writ large, as I say, is to reduce uncertainty, to help the decision maker make decisions. And it doesn't bother me to see the intelligence community move farther afield, move into open source literature and whatever, because their system and process of analysis is very useful and helpful in crystallizing issues for the decision maker. So I'm very comfortable with that. Now, one of the problems, though, is we have a small intelligence community and a huge demand for product. And our collection capabilities tend, in general, to far outpace our analytical capabilities, just by their very nature. I mean, we're sucking in information from around the world and from countries that 50 years ago we didn't even care about. But we still only have a limited number of analysts, limited number of interpreters, and those things. So the practical ability of the community is limited. I would say it ought to do what it can, but it needs to focus on those elements that only it does. That's a weasel worded answer, but it's the best I can do.
Can I have a second shot?
Sure.
That one of the things that we have talked about is the decision maker side of the equation. That you are a very, very experienced recipient, as well as tasker of the community. But preparing our policy-making customers to be good consumers of intelligence, to understand sort of what it is that we do, what we can't do, how to use this. What suggestions do you have on how we should be working that side of the problem?
I think to emphasize that this is not a horoscope operation, nor a crystal ball operation. It is an attempt, as I said, to reduce uncertainty. Not to eliminate uncertainty, to reduce uncertainty. Because if it were eliminated, the decision maker wouldn't need the intelligence community. And I think some warning. A president like George Bush Sr. didn't need any warning. He was DCI. He knew exactly what the product was and how to take advantage of it and so on. But a president who comes in not knowing the intelligence community may take it as gospel and certainty in a degree that it isn't. And so I think a quiet fireside chat between the president and the DNI could be very useful, not only the president, but a new administration in discussing some of the things that we talked about here now and what it really is they're getting and how best does the Intelligence Committee think they can use it.
We have a question from the audience and then that.
General Scowcroft, I'm Julian Mee from the National Defense Intelligence College on the faculty there. Mm-hmm. And right now I'm actually teaching a course on intelligence and national security policy. Next week we're talking about the role of the president, the NSC, and intelligence in that policy process. And one question I have for you is, in your two times as National Security Advisor, what is the relationship generally between the National Security Advisor and the Director of National Intelligence in that whole policy process? And are there certain factors or characteristics that make between the those two individuals that'll make that process work better or create problems?
Well, in my experience, it was a very close relationship, and informal, and discussing a lot of problems and how to put things in a particular way to make them more understandable and so on. I don't know when it's a distant relationship because I haven't had that experience. The problem always in something like that, though, is that you can't get so buddy-buddy that you want to help your friend. And that is one of the difficulties, that you instinctively want to put a little bit of English on the ball this way because you know that your friend wants it to go that way. And that's why President Bush Sr., for example, didn't want the DCI at that time in the policy meetings. He wanted it as pure as possible, not colored by personalities. No good answer to your question.
All right. Thanks, sir.
General Scowcroft, I want to pick up on something that Tom mentioned about preparing decision makers to be better consumers of intelligence. When you reflect in the sweep of history about when those moments of miscommunication happen, what in your estimate are the general or most important causes? Is it more misperception, wrong expectations on the part of the decision maker about what intelligence can do? Is it lack of specificity or precision in the analysis, or is it too hard to isolate those causes?
Well, no. I think you can divide it into three categories. On immediate intelligence, the decision maker accepts the intelligence virtually without question. We learned this yesterday, or this reliable source said this. Boom, right on. Midterm, not quite so confident. When it comes to long term, like some of the NIEs are, the decision maker, I must say, tends to think, well, my judgment is as good on these things as the intelligence community. You know, these are far outs. This is where the world's going to move and how it's going to move here. They don't know much more about it than I do. It's not true, but it tends to be the case. So that the longer out in the future the intelligence or the estimate is, the less likely it's to be accepted by the decision maker without question.
Randy Furston, Furston Associates. I did some of those intelligence estimates productions myself, and one of the things that we prided ourselves in the intelligence community was our ability to increase your anxiety. I mean, we knew how to warn and we could give you really the bad news, and we made sure you always knew how bad it could get. My question is the flip side of that. Did you often or ever get papers that said, we can identify a fantastic opportunity for you? And Jack Davis, we call it opportunities analysis. But there are things that you have control over that if you take advantage of what we see out there, you can have much greater value for the United States.
Rarely. Rarely.
Can you remember any?
No. No, but I suspect there were. Yeah, I suspect there were. But it doesn't happen very often. And indeed, most of the most of the estimates tend to be descriptive rather than prescriptive.
Rick Lempert, DHS. In a similar vein, I'm going to make an assumption, and if it's wrong, you can correct me. If it's correct, you can then answer the question that's based on it. My assumption is that you received intelligence briefings with equal confidence and, in a certain sense, equal paper credibility, but that when you read them, you gave some of them more weight and gave them more credibility than others that, you know, to a naive person would have been the same. If that assumption is correct, what distinguished intelligence which sort of spoke to you and you said, yeah, that's right, from intelligence that was put forth with the same official degree of confidence, but you said, you know, I really wonder about this, you better go back and check?
That's pretty easy, human nature. You always think something that agrees with your own views is more credible. I mean, and you know, it's not much more complicated than that.
Were you able to put that consciously aside at all?
Well, that's what you need to try to do. And that's what makes all of this, you know, most of what I talked about is this uncertainty. You want to reduce it to the degree you can, but not beyond what you can. If somebody says A and you think A is just terrific, you say, boy, that guy's a good analyst. If he says A and you think Z, you think, boy, he really screwed this one up.
Any ideas about how to overcome those biases in decision makers?
If it's important enough, the decision maker will ask and pursue the issue, and that's the best way to clear it up. But it's these subtleties that are in the back of your mind, you don't even articulate them to yourself.
I've heard many times analysts. I'm Deanna Caputo, and I'm from MITRE Corporation, and I was an Intel analyst previously. Sometimes I felt a number of analysts, and the experience has been sometimes they feel like they make assessments, and it's like the telephone when you're a child, and by the time it gets to the policymakers, the message has sort of changed, even if it's in writing.
Yeah.
Do you think that actual access from policymaker to actual analyst would in any way improve that communication where there was better information for you about real probabilities, or why not 100%? Why did you say 60%? Why is it not 20% certain? Do you think that would help?
Sure. Sure, I do. Yeah, it's most of the time it's not practical. On certain occasions, it's actually happened where there has been a particular point in an estimate of one kind that is controversial, and we've asked the analyst to come down and talk. So, yes, the more communication and the more accurate you can make the communication, better off you are. Absolutely.
Sir, I'm Brian Colder. I'm an independent consultant and neuroscientist, and I'm supporting NGA right now. I wonder if you could speculate on what it would take to affect some changes, low-level changes throughout the intelligence community in the way analysts actually do business. If this panel came up with some great ideas, and they were handed down to them from the Office of Director of National Intelligence. Would that work? Is there other things that would have to happen?
Well, I'm not the best one to ask that because, as I said, I don't really know the inner workings of the community. But from what I do know, I think it would be well received. I really do, because I think the analysts understand the things we're talking about and the things we've been pointing out are the problem areas. And anything which would improve their ability to communicate what they're trying to communicate to the decision maker more accurately, more succinctly, I think they'd welcome. So I would not think, no, this is a resistant bureaucracy that wants to do things the way it always has. I wouldn't worry about that. Okay.
And I'll make it quick. Keely Lang, National Warning Staff, National Intelligence Council. you've said a couple of things I'd like to follow up. One, generalized warning, and the farther out the information is, the more skeptical policymakers, decision makers are on it. Given the tempo of information coming in, there's an increased pressure to have current intelligence, this rapid turnaround reporting. How valuable is strategic, long-term, estimative intelligence to the policymaker? Are they still interested in strategic warning?
I think that it is valuable depending on how it's presented. And I think, as I said, sometimes I think the intelligence estimates are written for others in the community, not for the decision maker. Because on some of them, you know, they might be 60, 70 pages long, and I can't imagine a president getting past page 3. So it depends. But I think there is a definite market for them. And indeed, the influence of a few of the more recent ones that have maybe not been exactly what they should be indicates how important they can be. So especially if they're written in a way which the decision maker thinks are relevant either to his immediate concerns or to how those concerns might affect the longer term future. So yeah, but they need to be done right and well, or otherwise they're a waste of time.
Let me thank General Scowcroft.
Thank you all.